This is Fresh Air. Stephen Sondheim's new musical, Passion, opens tonight on Broadway. It's based on the 1869 novel Fosca, set in late 19th century Italy, about the consequences of a woman's unrequited love for a handsome young army captain. Last fall, Stephen Sondheim spoke at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, where he responded to questions from the audience. We're going to hear highlights of that event. Sondheim started his Broadway career as the lyricist for West Side Story and Gypsy. He's since written words and music for such shows as Company, Follies, Sweeney Todd, Pacific Overtures, Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, and Assassins. Sondheim says his new musical, Passion, is about dark impulses, like Sweeney Todd. So let's hear some music from Sweeney. Sweeney is a barber who has just returned from prison. He learns that the judge who put him away raped Sweeney's wife, then took Sweeney's daughter as his ward. Now the judge plans to marry her. Sweeney is obsessed with revenge. After missing his chance to slit the judge's throat, Sweeney vows to slit the throats of all his customers.
They all deserve to die. Tell your why, Mrs. Love, tell your why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place, and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. Though we all deserve to die, tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die. And I'll never see Joanna. No, I'll never hug my girl to be finished. All right, you sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You sir, too sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, waiters. You, sir? Anybody? Gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor 10 men, nor 100 can assuage. And I will get him back even as he gloats.
Stephen Sondheim's mentor was lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. When Sondheim was 17, he apprenticed Hammerstein for $25 a week. At the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, Sondheim was asked about Oscar Hammerstein's influence.
I got to know him when I was 11 years old. My parents had been divorced, and my mother... I lived with my mother in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, part of the time. She worked in New York, but she bought a place out there and lived near the Hammersteins, and they had a son my age, a year younger, but and we became fast friends, and I sort of osmosed myself in the Hammerstein household. And I, he was sort of surrogate father. I saw my father in, not as frequently as I wished because I liked him a lot, but I needed a surrogate, so Oscar was a surrogate. And I think, I've said this many times before, if he'd been a geologist, I would have been a geologist. I just wanted to be what he was. And luckily for me, he was a songwriter. And every time I would write anything, I wrote a show for school, brought it to him, and he would, you know, give criticism. And he got me everything I wrote right up until the day he died, I showed him.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of writers and critics that say that while he was a great influence, that you are totally different than he.
He encouraged me to do that. When I was first writing love songs, so at the age of 18, I would write about larks learning to pray. And, and he would say to me, but you know, you don't believe this stuff. I said, no, but it, I mean, what, he said, what do you feel about it? I said, well, I don't know. He said, have you ever been in love? I said, no. He said, well, then you have to try to get inside the character that you're writing for. But don't write what I write. Write what you write. Then he said something really smart. He said, and if you do that, he said, you'll be 90% ahead of everybody else. And as soon as he put it on a competitive level, a little click went off in my head, you know? But what he meant was that most people do not write for character. They write, or even out of their own hearts, at least in the musical theater in those days. He was one of the few who did. They wrote according to a sort of standard set of feelings. You know, it used to be called pop song feelings, or it used to be called June Moon feelings. Oscar was one of the few people who understood writing for character, and that's what he was telling me to do. And that lesson probably was the single most valuable one I ever learned.
Let me turn this to the audience. Yes.
I just want to get your, I've always been really super fan of yours, and I've always really been confused by a distinction that you've always made between the popular songs, you say character songs in musical theater, and then songs you just mentioned before that are written by a pop
standard. I meant standardized feelings. Standardized feelings.
Standardized feelings. I'm curious, like you've said that West Side Story, that you've always kind of been shaky about the lyric, it's alarming how charming I feel, mm-hmm. and so on, but don't you think though that what I'm curious is that all the characters are, I mean, they're obviously in your own voice to an extent.
They shouldn't be. If they are, then I failed.
But do you think so? Mm-hmm. Do you think you can actually get outside of your own...
Absolutely,
perception?
That's what a playwright does. A good playwright, you know, Shakespeare wasn't right, you know, Hamlet is not Shakespeare's voice. And, now there are certain plays, you know, I'm sure Death of a Salesman is very much part of Arthur Miller's voice, because very much, but I don't think The Crucible is. I mean, I think a playwright invents, and obviously there's an emotional connection you make with characters, but I don't think voice at all. No, where I think that lyrics are successful or best in West Side Story is where, in fact, they do fit the character, which I don't express myself like the Jets song, but I think the Jets song is a good lyric. And it's not the distinction between popular song. I really was trying to make the distinction between specific emotions for characters and generalized emotions, which is up until Rodgers and Hammerstein, or up until Hammerstein, because he really started in the Showboat. Well, everything was generalized. He was the first, and he was the pioneer, and he's the giant on which everybody's on whose shoulders everybody stands, because he tried to take the specific characterizations that come from opera and even operetta and put them into musical comedy. And he did. And started with Showboat. And he was doing it all through the 30s too, but the shows were flops. And then he got to Oklahoma, and because the show was so successful, it influenced everybody. That's the whole thing. It's a show has to be successful to influence it. And Oklahoma, you cannot take lyrics from one character and put them into the mouths of others. You can sometimes, because it's not refined yet. And as he went on, that distinction got more. But I don't think you should be able to do that any more than a playwright in a good play. You should be able to take a speech from one character and give it to another without it sounding wrong.
Yes.
Can I have a musical history question for you, just for the record, because I think you might be one of the few people who knows. You talk a lot about Oscar Hammerstein, and I know you were close with him. Did he ever mention at any time the circumstances in which... Because he had two careers, really, and especially the second part of his life with Dick Rogers. And did he ever mention the circumstances upon which Rogers and Hart broke up, and then how he came in after that?
No, this is fairly well documented, and I don't think it's up to me to say it, but that's fairly well documented. But no, he never commented on that.
Did he ever comment professionally or personally on?
He defended. I didn't like Hart's lyrics, and I still have problems with them because they're so sloppy technically. And he had taught me to be technically rigorous, you see. So when I would sneer at a Larry Hart lyric, he would say, "You're ignoring something." Yes, they're technically sloppy. He would certainly admit that. He said, "But Larry Hart was the first person I can't remember the exact phrase he used, but the idea was to bring the language of lyrics to a kind of contemporary conversational street level, so to speak." And he admired Hart for just that, and he made me understand that, you know, because I was too young to have been in the history of it, that what Hart's influence on the theater was to bring lyrics down to a colloquial level. Now, I prefer much Dorothy Fields, who does the same thing, but who's impeccable in terms of technique and whose lyrics flow smoothly, whereas Larry Hart writes, "Lover, when I'm near you and I hear you breathe my name, lover, in my ear you breathe a flame." And I just think, "Lover, in my ear, you breathe a flame," is simply not the way people talk. And that's what I mean. I think he was lazy. And in fact, it's documented that he was lazy. He was clearly extraordinarily gifted And Dick Rogers had to practically beat him up to get him to finish a lyric because he was just too lazy.
We're listening to Stephen Sondheim recorded at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a question and answer session with Stephen Sondheim at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. One member of the audience had recently seen the documentary about making the cast recording of Sondheim's musical Company. The film showed Sondheim coaching the performers in their phrasing and diction. This led to a question about how much leeway Sondheim gives actors on cast albums.
Some of the most exciting show albums are not perfect the way pop albums are. Now, one of the main reason is that you don't have the time to do a show album that you do. A pop album, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent. It's over a period of months. A show album is done one day. And that means everybody gets like one or two takes. So what you get is flaws. But what you also get is the adrenaline. It's not manicured. It's not just about whether it's opera singing or not, but what it has is the excitement that a show has. The whole idea of a show, as opposed to a movie, is that it's imperfect. That the audience should know that they're there that night seeing something unique. That's why audiences love it when an actor goes up. It isn't, they're not laughing at, they're not happy because the actor's humiliated. It makes it a unique experience. It is not preformed. And it's not Fahrenheit 451. You're a human being in a human place, and it's a community experience. That kind of thing can be captured. You listen to the opening of Company, and I say this she admits it herself, you listen to Elaine Stritch sing flat throughout the entire opening number. That's what gives it its life. I don't mean that I want her to do that, but it's acceptable because it's live.
Yes.
I've been thinking about this notion of community experience and the kind of intimacy that that presumes. And you've just spoken a little bit about the excitement and passion that you get about the audience reaction. The question is with the emphasis on spectacle in musicals. Now, it's almost as if that creates a distancing. And could you comment on that and where you see your work?
There's nothing to comment on. I mean... The bread and circuses, circuses are just as important as bread. It's when it's either too much bread or too much circuses that I turn off, and that's what you're talking about. If there's too much spectacle and it distances you from the story, and you're only enjoying the spectacle, then you might as well go to the Radio City Music Hall. And if it doesn't have that, then you might as well not have a musical, because there's something celebratory. Even if it can be a simple stage set, but just in the staging, just in the way people move. You don't have to dance, you don't have to elaborate costume. But that's the circus part of it. It can't just be the bread. And for my taste, now, what happens now, because tickets are so expensive, I mean, this is obvious to everybody in the room, I'm sure, but tickets are so expensive, and shows are so expensive, that tickets have to be expensive, that what used to be a theater-going habit now becomes once a year. You go on your anniversary or Christmas present or somebody's birthday, and you spend a lot of money and hope you go, well, what are you going to, if you're going to go just one night a year and you're going to go to a musical, you're going to go to a big hit. You're going to go to whatever the big hit. Now, the biggest hits are going to be the ones where the people feel that they're getting them their money's worth, either in terms of spectacle, length, whatever it is. But the feeling that they've spent the money and that the evening was worth it. And those shows then become the show to see. If this were 50 years ago, you'd see those and you'd see the more modest shows. But when people only have one choice, I can't blame them. And they'll order the tickets a year in advance because it's hard. I've often said this, but many people, you'll say, what'd you think of such and such a show? Referring to a hard to get into a hit. What'd you think of such and such a show? They'll say, we had wonderful seats. It's the event. It's the going to the theater as opposed to the show. That's what's happened when you can only go once a year and you have to spend so much money. It's the event. So of course it's we had great seats and we ordered them a year in advance. Of course that makes sense. And it's about the souvenir program. That's what.
We'll take another question from upstairs.
Yes, I was wondering, on the shows that you wrote only lyrics for, I was wondering if you also wrote some of the music to them, especially like the Richard Rodgers show.
No. What I did with Rodgers, I did something similar with Julie Stein. Rodgers was used to getting a lyric first from Oscar. I said, "Would you like to work this way?" And He said, fine. So I would sketch out a lyric, and I'd sketch it on music paper with no notes, but with the melodic rhythm indicated. Then Rogers would take off from that. He did not necessarily follow it, but he knew at least what I had in mind in terms of bars and general the structure of the lengths of lines. Dick was very concerned that everything add up to multiples of four. He would count the bars, 4, 8. And if it came out to 13, he was real upset. And of course, I'd worked with Leonard Bernstein, who if it came out to a multiple of 4, would add a bar. So we had to adjust that. I did that similarly with Julie. And in the case of Rose's Turn, I took a lot of his tunes and mashed them together, worked out a sketch with Jerry Robbins. And that's it. And I did a little vamp here and there in West Side. But no, my contribution was essentially lyric. And in the case of, in all three, I would occasionally write out rhythms.
We're listening to a question and answer session with Stephen Sondheim. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a question and answer session with Stephen Sondheim, recorded at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. The moderator asked Sondheim if it was true that he considered it a setback when he agreed to write lyrics for Leonard Bernstein's score for West Side Story.
I want to write music and lyrics, but, you know, then this offer came along, and I thought, well, I'd be frustrated just writing lyrics, which, in fact, in a way I was, but not when working with Lenny. And it was Oscar Hammerstein who said, you have a chance to work with these three extraordinarily talented and experienced people, Arthur Lawrence, Jerome Robbins, and Leonard Bernstein. I said, I got it. And he wanted me to take it on as a teaching experience, a learning experience, which it was. I learned from each of those men so much that, you know, as much as in a way that I, as I did from Oscar, and each in a different way. And so I'm not in any way sorry for the experience, but I wanted to write music. I much prefer writing music to lyrics, because lyrics is much, you know, it's sweat work, and music's fun. And so it wasn't a setback. The setback was when I was supposed to do music and lyrics for Gypsy, and David Merrick and Leland Hayward, who were producing it, was okay with them, okay with Arthur Lawrence, and Ethel Merman had just been burned by two young writers, that is to say, she had had a flop and blamed it on the inexperience or having two young writers, a show called Happy Hunting. So she was very wary of taking a chance on another one. So she said no. And then Arthur and Oscar again. Oscar said, it'll frustrate you even more, but now you have a chance to write for a specific personality, and that's something you should learn to do. And he was right. That was also very valuable, because we wrote that show not for Madame Rose, but for Ethel Merman as Madame Rose, because she and David Merrick came up with the idea together to buy Gypsy Rose Lee's book, and so she came with the package. We wrote it very quickly, and we tailored it to her, and that show was written for her as Madame Rose, and that's a very, very valuable thing to have.
Yes.
You've spoken about him a couple of times peripherally, but I was wondering if you could more directly comment on Leonard Bernstein. His composing his place in theater history.
Oh, I do not believe in taking overviews. When I take an overview, like when I talk about Oscar and the development of musical comedy, that's about the development. You know, I can't talk about Lenny in terms of any kind of development, and I would never dream of trying to assess an artist. I'm not a critic.
I was thinking more about his influence, if any, on you.
Well, his influence on me mainly came down to philosophical influence. He once said, one of the things I remember him saying was that if you're going to, I paraphrase, but this was the metaphor he used, that if you're going to fall off the ladder, be sure you fall from a high rung, not from a low rung, which is why when he failed, they were huge failures. I mean, when he made a mistake or when he did something wrong or something, it was a big, pretentious failure, not a mini, mingy, sniveling little failure. And that's why, therefore, when he was successful, they're also huge. That was a very good lesson to learn, because up until then, my tendency always was to be slightly cautious. And although I should have been more influenced. What happened was, when I was 17, I was a gopher for Oscar on a show called Allegro. And they had written Oklahoma and Carousel, these two gigantic hits. And he tried a genuinely experimental show, and it flopped. And I have a feeling that I may have gotten slightly wary, because it was a terrible disappointment to him, and it was really going out on a limb. So my first experience was watching a man go out on a limb and get chopped off. Now, that it was an unconscious thing, but luckily, because Lenny and Jerry and Arthur were fearless, that was quickly healed. And, you know, from then on, I love to take chances. But I'm speculating. There may have been it. But that's one of the things I learned from Lenny was, if you're going to take a chance, take a big chance. Don't take a little chance.
Stephen Sondheim. His new musical, Passion, opens tonight on Broadway. Our thanks to the staff of the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, where Sondheim's talk was recorded.